No, they go to the Federal Reserve and say, we'd like to borrow some of your money. So they say, oh, not a problem. And they'll put the order back to the Treasury Department of the government that prints up the money, send it over to the Federal Reserve and sends it back to the government. And why is that little dance going on? Well, the whole thing is just to not make it obvious where the money comes from. But hey, folks, the money's being printed out of thin air. So it's very rare that you actually see what Ilana Mercer is talking about here. And I see the time's running out, so I better get talking about what she's talking about. Yale professor William Nordis and the Council on Foreign Relations say that the eventual cost of the war in Iraq will be roughly $1.2 trillion. Think about that. We've heard all these different estimates. Now, Bush right now is proposing a budget that's supposedly going to be a third of a trillion short. But that doesn't include the so-called off-budget spending. So it's actually going to be closer to two-thirds of a trillion. And she asks, and since there's no free lunch, who's going to pay for this debauchery? Well, very simply, you, the ordinary common taxpayer. The finances for war, of course, will come from the private economy. For every dollar the government spends, a dollar is suctioned from you and me. Wartime socialism thus involves a massive transfer of private property to state ownership. And she goes on to quote Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan, there's a story about Ronald Reagan that when he was elected and was in the White House and someone gave him a little talk about, you know, Mr. President, it's not quite the way you seem to think, and explain who was in charge and who was running things. And Ronald Reagan supposedly wandered around the White House for quite a few weeks saying, I just can't believe it. I just can't believe it. I don't understand it. And whether that's true or not true, I don't know. But anyway, she quotes Ronald Reagan, who said, the truth is inflation is caused by government spending more than it takes in. Very seldom you get such a direct statement. You know, you hear the mainstream news. They're always talking about Alan Greenspan and how he's regulating inflation. He's like the captain of this great economic ship going up the river and so forth. And isn't it wonderful this Greenspan can pilot the river and he's keeping inflation in control and so forth. It's like inflation happens like the rainfall or the wind or something like that. Now, there's no, that could be so further from the truth. Inflation is simply caused by the government spending far more than it's taken in. So what does the government do? Well, she goes on, more precisely, having adopted deficit spending as an article of faith, Bush will call on the Federal Reserve and the printing press to print money in order to pay for the cost of the war. Inflation is an increase in the money supply. And she describes this as nothing less than legalized counterfeiting, but the new money will generate price hikes throughout the economy. And she makes a very good point about how the people who obtain this money hot off the press will have more purchasing powers before their increased money percolates through the economy and bids up all the prices. Whoever's in charge of the printing press and has the first crack with the new money is the one who's going to be able to buy by far more things. Since there are no freebies, those working for this centrally planned command economy will benefit while others will foot the bill. And that's the real truth about this whole business with the Federal Reserve System. It benefits the few at the expense of the many. That's why it exists. You wonder why such a terrible system that embezzles the wealth out of the average citizen. Why in the world would we put up with such a terrible system? Well, it's very simple. We have some very vested interests in this country right now, and the few will benefit at the expense of the many. And that seems to be so true of so much of our government right now. You always have to, you know, you hear the expression over and over again, follow the money. I think it's one of the, if you really want to understand what in the world is going on, I would say not only follow the money, but study money itself. There's no better book for most folks, if you want to go to it in any depth, than getting Ed Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. D.D. Kidd also has a great book called, it's a, more of a pamphlet. If you don't have much time, get it. Why a Bankrupt America. Well, this is Tom Clooney, and I'll be with you next week. Thank you very much.
Well, we had a few callers today.
Good. Ask. Get through?
Got him on the line.
Oh, fine. Okay. Well, you're going to have to screen him open.
Thank you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please, of course, why don't you hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line from Southern California, Kevin Shannon. Kevin, how are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. It's great to have you with us. And Kevin has his own radio show in Southern California. He's with the Welch Report, and he's been on the front lines of trying to educate people for many years about what's really going on in the world today. So, Kevin, you know, as we look and we see, and certainly America's gone to war, we're going to bring democracy to all the countries of the Middle East, and then democracies to, well, maybe North Korea, and we're going to push democracy throughout the world. But, you know, that's so reminiscent of the slogan that was used to justify the First World War, the war to make the world safe for democracy. And, of course, the problem we get into is that America isn't a democracy. We're a republic. Why don't we want to bring our form of freedom to countries throughout the world? Why do we want to bring the same sort of system that resulted in the rise of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini to the governments of the Middle East?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. Historian John B. Judas has pointed out that really the chief founders of what is now called neoconservatism, anywhere from Irving Kristol and Norman Podhoretz, really began their political careers as followers of Leon Trotsky, and who was really the creator of the Soviet Red Army, an advocate of the permanent revolution. And unlike Stalin, who preferred to consolidate socialism in one country, Trotsky believed in exporting the communist revolution worldwide through subversion and violence. And in a sense, now we have the neoconservatives, who really do not honor the Constitution, saying we're going to export democracy first throughout the Middle East and then throughout the world. So we're looking at this sort of empire building in the name of democracy, of course, which Karl Marx called for in the Communist Manifesto, was winning the battle for democracy. So they use terms mean things, but a lot of people don't understand the terms that are often used, so they're misled very easily.
Now, I think for our listeners, you probably should try to explain why Norman Podhoretz is important in this whole discussion of our policy towards the Middle East.
Well, again, you see, he's kind of considered, I've heard people describe him as the godfather of the neoconservative movement. There's a very strong influence in the Bush administration currently. These people were not created by the Bush administration at all. They've been around for a number of years and were trying to influence even the Clinton administration. But I think right now it's because of their influence that thought has so much influence in the current administration. That's why I'm concerned about it.
All right, fine. Well, I think that we have to understand is a little group called the Project for the New American Century.
Oh, yes, exactly.
And, of course, there were 25 people who got together in the spring of 1997 and decided they were going to take over our government and bring about an American empire, and that we were going to create a new international order for our profit and our principles. And now anybody who wants to check that fact out goes to their website, newamericancentury.org, and you look up Their statement of principles, which was signed on the 3rd of June in 1997, and one of the original 25 signers of this, along with certainly Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and Jeb Bush and Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton, was a man named Norman Potterotz.
He's right there, along with someone else in the news recently, William J. Bennett.
William J. Bennett, of course, a great Christian leader who's written books on the Book of Values.
Yes.
They just found out that he had lost $8 million gambling in the casino. He's one of the biggest gamblers in the country. Well, of course, maybe he doesn't think there's anything wrong with losing $8 million at the gambling tables. He claims he didn't lose that much. They said that they didn't mention how much he actually won, and he'd given a lot of this to charity. But, of course, anybody who believes that you can play and play and play and never lose any money, in fact, you're really making money and giving it to charity, has got to be incredibly naive.
Yeah, it's disgusting. He, there's no indication. They're not accusing him of doing anything illegal. But certainly, people who are high-stakes gamblers put themselves in positions where they can be blackmailed and influenced. And so even in law enforcement, if you have, problems with gambling and you're involved in it excessively, you're considered, or you used to be, things have changed, a security risk. And, of course, he has held high positions in government. So
he was Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan.
And he was also the drug czar.
Oh, yes, the drug czar.
You know, so like you say, this, it's amazing when you look at the neoconservatives. When you go to the Project for the New American Century and you see these names and you see what they put right out there for us to look at, in one sense, it's hard to call it a conspiracy.
No, of course, it isn't a conspiracy. It's hidden in plain sight. But, well, the important thing is that you're not going to hear about this from the mainline media. The mainline media, of course, is going to talk about other things. Once in a while, you will see this, though, and certainly on the 5th of March of last month, why on Nightline, Ted Koppel interviewed William Crystal, who was chairman of the of this group, Project for the New American Century, and he laid the whole thing out, how we were going to simply replace the government of Iran and replace the government of Iraq after we got through with, pardon me, of Saudi Arabia, after we got through, doing our work there. So basically, hopefully, we're connected up now with the Great Northwest by the miracle of telephone lines. So our listeners up in Washington, and for the people who just come online with us, the guest this evening is Kevin Shannon, who has his own radio program in Southern California, and Kevin's kind enough to come on with us and share his thoughts about what's going on. We were simply talking to this group called Project for the New American Century that planned the war in Iraq going back to 1997. And, of course, telling our listeners, if you don't believe it, go to their website, newamericancentury.org, or if you want to verify it, you can, of course, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And we'll bring you a copy, or send you a copy free of charge of my March newsletter, which lays everything out and tells you where you can go in their website to find this incredible plan to create an American empire. And, of course, America is to change and replace all of the governments of the Middle East. Now, I may not like the governments there, and I may feel that we've got real problems with, say, the government of Iran, but I'm old enough to remember when we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. First in 1953, we overthrew Prime Minister Mossadegh, who was elected by the Iranian people, and put in the Shah of Iran. And then we helped the Shah of Iran for a period of, from 1953 until 1979. That's almost 26 years. And then in July of that year, we overthrew the Shah of Iran, and we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power, because once we overthrew the Shah by destabilizing his government, putting an arms embargo on him, telling the army not to enforce the laws, letting chaos take over, and then sending our ambassador to the Shah and telling him he would leave Iran the next day, we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. So we put this radical Islamic government in power, but people have forgotten that. people have such short memories, and as somebody once said, the one thing we learn from history is that we don't learn anything from history.
Well, unfortunately, that's true for too many people, but, you know, we are in certainly the most dangerous time since our nation came into existence, in my opinion. I've never been an alarmist. I've been a person who has a lot of hope, a lot of faith, and I still believe that we have enough liberty to restore our republic and to turn the tide away from this global police state that is growing through the United Nations, a national police state, through things like the Patriot II and something I'm very concerned about, the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003. Some people call it Patriot II. We see the Hegelian dialectic at work. We see that problems are either created or exacerbated so that they have to give us a solution. And right now we're giving up liberty for security, and people don't realize that the very people we're looking to for security have laid the groundwork, have created, in many instances, our enemies, have allowed a climate in which terrorism could grow, terrorist training camps in America, so that as terrorism occurs, those who want the power have the excuse to take it in the name of giving you and I security. And I'm very, very concerned about this Domestic Security Enhancement Act. I mean, it just, in many ways, eviscerates the Constitution, and I think for groups like Radio Liberty, the Welch Report, Gun Owners of America, Jews for the Preservation, any of the constitutionalist organizations are going to be able to be threatened and intimidated if this legislation goes through, and people need to take action.
Well, not only that, but there was information today that we got that the government now is hired a company to begin collecting information on everybody in Central and South America. If anybody would like to see the article, it just appeared yesterday. But basically what they've done is they're trying to get the names, addresses, pictures, description, bank accounts, all the records on everybody living in Central and South America. Now, why would we want to do something like that? Well, people have to understand that in the name of fighting terrorism, we plan, of course, to have dossiers on everybody in the world. Because if you're going to have a world government, a world dictatorship, you have to have all of this information. If we're going to have a world where you'll need to be able to buy or sell, lest you be known by the mark of the beast or the number of your name, why, we've got to have all of this information on file. And my concern is this is exactly the direction we're going.
We really are. And, you know, it's amazing that they were so bold, these people who are seeking to consolidate power, that they used, you know, for their emblem on the Information Awareness Office, the all-seeing eye on the pyramid looking over the entire planet. You know, apparently enough of us, you know, pointed people in that direction that they've taken down the artwork. It is still available. But, you know, these people are really, I believe, a manifestation of a spiritual battle, spiritual warfare. Some people don't like to talk about that, but unless we see the enemy, the true enemy, we're not going to know how to fight them. And so we're talking about, in my opinion, a geopolitical manifestation of the war between the Holy Creator and Christianity and all cultures based on Christianity and satanic forces, occultic forces. And they manifest themselves in these people who are you know, power hungry. They don't honor God's law, so certainly they're not going to respect something like the Constitution that is merely man's law in their view.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think the great tragedy is that most people have no idea at all what's going on in America, and they're certainly not going to learn from you know, our government. They're not going to learn from anybody else. But there is a plan that's being carried out thoroughly at the present time, very carefully and diabolically. And so our goal, of course, is to try to educate you and the listening audience to what's really going on. And we're going to be right back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest this evening is Kevin Shannon. And Kevin, why don't you get a little information out how people can get in touch with you if they'd like to?
Well, if people are interested in what we do, Obviously, the easiest way is to use the technology of the internet, and we have a site at
Hello, Kevin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. I don't know what happened there. We seem to have lost you for a time, and we're still hooked up, though. Anyway, we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest. And, of course, our guest is Kevin Shannon. We're talking about the New World Order. So why don't you go ahead and pick up the story where you left off?
Well, you know, we were discussing, of course, this concept that there are those who are willing to bring about because they have a rejection of God's law and, of course, certainly no respect for the Constitution. And I was making the point that I believe that what we see is really a manifestation of a spiritual battle, and that it's going to take Americans of goodwill to honor God before we can sincerely ask Him to bless America. You know, I think first He has to forgive us. I think that as a nation, we need to, stand up for His principle, restore biblical values. Otherwise, this move towards the New World Order, I think, can be looked at as a righteous judgment of God upon a man who has turned against them. Just like in the book of Joel, when people stopped honoring God as the creator, He used an army of locusts, of all things, to come upon them and bring in-time judgment, because He can only bring judgment on nations in time. Our judgment is after, but in time for nations. And we have allowed Him to be removed from the public realm, basically. We've dishonored Him. And so I think that this New World Order can be turned around if our nation and individuals turn around, turn back towards God, and take a stand based on principle.
Well, I agree with you totally, Seth. But, you know, the thing is that where were the churches when they took God out of our schools and God and prayer out of our schools? Why didn't the churches speak up? And, of course, they didn't speak up. They simply had been taught a false gospel for such a long time that they felt that, all you have to do is just honor the government, that God put these wicked people into power over us. God didn't put them there. Lucifer put them there. If you believe there's a spiritual battle, we know why they took God out of our schools. And the reason why was because the Masons controlled our Supreme Court. Why won't our churches speak out about Masons? Why do they put on programs on cults but never mention Masonry, which is the largest, most powerful cult in America? And it's simply because we have more ministers who have more fear of government than they have of God.
Well, that's what I found. And, of course, I was a minister for many years after I was a police officer for just a few years. And I found that to be true. There was a lot of good men, but then there was a lot of men who have been indoctrinated by liberal seminaries, who no longer look to the Bible as revelation. They really have the Hellenistic a worldview where they can use man's reasoning, and that becomes supreme over God's revelation. And so they have sold out. They have misinterpreted Scripture. Obviously, God did create government. He created nations. He didn't want a new world order. He took a stand against it, the Tower of Babel, and created nationhood. And so a lot of preachers have sold out because they're afraid of losing tax status,
someone gets applauded,
and a lot of other reasons. And there's war.
Okay, go right ahead. We seem to be having a few technical difficulties tonight, more than I've ever remembered before. But go ahead.
You know what? Every time we have technical difficulties, and I don't care where you broadcast, we get people calling up and
Go ahead.
And they look out the window for black helicopters, but the reality is there is just a time. So I saw many preachers who have lost their spine. You know, where are the Daniels? That is what we need today. And many of the pulpits have sold out to this social gospel. And we're paying a great price. And we're paying a great price. I hope a lot of our conservative listeners who believe the Republicans are always standing for liberty take a serious look at the implications for this war we had in Iraq. A war which I think, although they say the major hostilities are over, is going to last a long time. But there's a lot of things, as a result of that war, they're going to really help the architects of this so-called New World Order. And, you know, right down to the backlash that's going to fuel recruitment of terrorists and subvert moderate Arab regimes as we continue to involve ourselves in the Middle East. And then the other thing that Bush is already talking about doing is what his father did after the first Gulf War, and that's to import lots of Iraqis over here to America. And it's very dangerous because there's good evidence that it was Iraqi Republican Guards and others who helped Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, you know, bring about the Oklahoma City bombing. We imported tens of thousands of these people, and now we're talking about doing it again, and it's extremely dangerous.
I agree with you totally. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is one of those evenings when I think just about everything possible has gone wrong, but we're still hoping that things are going to get better. Of course, we're so grateful that Kevin is with us this evening, as we're having an opportunity to evaluate what's going on and talking about what's happening. And not quite sure why we can't hook up to the regular lines with our friends up in the Great Northwest, but it seems that on every Monday evening we have the same sort of a problem. Under any circumstances, we're talking about what's going on as far as our war in the Middle East. And this was planned long, long, long before George Bush became president. And of course, I just was back in Washington, D.C. at a meeting, and it was amazing. Who did they bring to talk to the assembled guests but the members of the Project for the New American Century to actually get everybody behind the government? And the president's representative was there and other people. And the whole theme was, well, you know, you're going to have to give up some of your freedom in wartime. But, you know, that's only temporary. Once the war is over, why, you'll get your freedom back. They don't understand, the average individual doesn't understand, that they don't intend for this war to end. This war is going to continue on and on and on. Now, why do we need the USA Patriot Act? After all, they've caught just so many of the Al-Qaeda and the top leaders of Al-Qaeda. I mean, who is really behind this war on terrorism now that most of the leaders of Al-Qaeda have been caught? Certainly, there have been no major attacks in the United States since the anthrax attack shortly after 9-1-1, and all the evidence suggests that actually came from our own military laboratory. So, you know, the information that's there certainly would suggest that the American people, you know, are really not being told the truth. We have the ability to track down everybody in this entire world. We have satellites that can search neighborhoods. We have the ability to track every telephone call in the world, every fax, every email. The only way that the terrorists could still continue to work now would be by carrier pigeon. And if you don't think that we have the Islamic terrorist movement thoroughly infiltrated, and if we don't, the Mossad does, well, you're sadly mistaken. We had it infiltrated before the 9-1-1 attack. And the idea that we had no idea what was coming down, well, if we had no idea, why did somebody warn Willie Brown not to fly on the 11th of September? And the leaders of our military, why did they cancel their flights for September 11th? And really, how was it that there were no planes in the air that morning? And, you know, there's so many unanswered questions. And why is the government so intent upon preventing any effective investigation of what happened on that morning?
You know, that's true, and the Bush administration has done all it can to keep a thorough investigation from being accomplished. You know, we were told that it was our war in Iraq was in response to 9/11, yet Secretary Rice, a national security advisor, actually, gave a speech a year and a half before 9/11 saying that Saddam is going to be removed, that he has to be removed, that that's part of the Bush agenda. So there's no question that this move into Iraq was planned. 9/11 certainly gave a good cover, as well as a lot of other mispropaganda. They talked about weapons of mass destruction. I'm convinced there were weapons of mass destruction, but we don't have the right to attack every nation that has weapons. They, in Iraq, really are one of the least capable nations to attack us. There are far more serious threats to us. China, Russia, both who are the primary, still to this day, the primary sponsors of worldwide terrorism. Now, much of it's being funded by Saudi Arabia. There's no question about that. But isn't it interesting that we call the Soviets and the Chinese our allies, even though they helped up to and during the war in Iraq, the enemy we're fighting? But they're our allies, and we say we've got to remain partners for them. It comes right out of 7277 that many people have heard of, this plan to disarm the United States and the world in three phases, building up the United Nations, so eventually the nation states that actually will begin to dissolve will only have the military to maintain internal order. And that's what we see, all this massive concentration of police powers in the central government and in the executive branch. They're really covering out what is in the program that people could have read at any time for decades in the 7277. Ultimately, the UN will have the only credible military force because the United States military will be primarily under their control, or the UN will be under these elitist control, and so there'll be no resistance to it. And this is what we see occurring right before us day by day.
And, of course, the tragedy is the American people don't understand this whole thing is a scam. Let's go back into the background of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was employed by the Central Intelligence Agency. How do we know that? Well, there's a book written a decade ago called Unholy Babylon, and anybody wants to see the section there, you can give us a call or try to get a copy of the book. But this was written long before, you know, the current times, and I think 1990, 1991. And it pointed out that Saddam Hussein and a group of men he was with had actually employed by the Central Intelligence Agency to actually assassinate the leader of Iraq at that time. And then, of course, about 1969, why the Ba'ath Party with 900 people takes over the nation of 25 million. Now, do you honestly believe they did that without CIA help? We know that the CIA and our government worked with Saddam Hussein all during the 1980s, and we lent him the money. We sold him the chemical weapons. He used those chemical weapons on the people, the helpless people, soldiers of Iran. And after he had used this, the chemical weapons in violation of every international law, we continued to back him. We continued to finance him. And if you doubt that, you can go to my website and pull down my newsletters, or if you'd like, some articles about how we gave Saddam $5 billion in agricultural credits, which he then was able to sell and actually then able to purchase weapons with shortly before the first Gulf War. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for the Washington Post article on Saddam Hussein. And of course, how we actually allowed him to buy the chemical and biological weapons we're so concerned about today. It's covered in a book called Against All Enemies by Seymour Hersh, which we carry. All of this information is well known. And so if it's well known, why is it that the American people don't know it? And it is simply because the reality of the American people is controlled very tightly by the people who control the media here. And there'll be articles published in Europe, which you will never see here published in the United States. For instance, the article that appeared in La Figueroa shortly after the 9/11 attack, pointing out that Osama bin Laden was at the American hospital in Dubai from the 4th to about the 12th of July of the year 2001, just about 2 months before the September 11th attack. And, of course, while he was there, he was meeting with the CIA, and La Figueroa said that they felt Osama bin Laden was a CIA agent. Isn't it interesting that all of Osama bin Laden's lieutenants have been captured, but Osama hasn't? Do you think there's any relationship between the fact that the bin Laden family is very, very close to the Bushes? In fact, do you remember who it was who tried to kill President Reagan? Why, was the son of one of George Bush's best friends. And, of course, isn't it interesting that he's on such good terms with the bin Laden family, and, of course, the man who heads this whole world al-Qaeda movement that threatens us and for which we have to give up our freedom because al-Qaeda's out there. This whole thing ties in so closely to George Herbert Walker Bush, a member of Skull and Bones, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, on the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the American front organization for a secret English society created by Cecil Rhodes. That's covered in Professor Quigley's book, pages 951 and 952. George Bush was a member of the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. And, of course, among his close friends were the Bin Ladens. They were heavily invested in Carlyle, which he is a consultant for, Carlyle Corporation. And isn't it just such a coincidence that it was their relative, Osama Bin Laden, who's behind this whole international terrorist movement, funded by the Saudis. And then, of course, when families of the victims of 9/11 wanted to sue the Saudi princes who were funding Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, why the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, wouldn't let them. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, there's something very seriously wrong, and people need to open their eyes and begin to look beyond party affiliation. Just as Washington warned us against, loyalty to party, was very dangerous. Theodore Roosevelt reiterated that, really, saying that patriotism was loyalty to the Constitution, not a party. And what has happened, I think, is that many people, especially those of us who were raised in the conservative element of the Republican Party, we used to always assume, you know, if they're Republican, they were the good guys. But how naive we are at times, without excuse, because the very clear biblical principle that the people we need to be very wary of are the wolves in sheep's clothing. And certainly, just as there can be imitators of Christ, you know, people who would come to us like the innocent lamb trying to make up that we would have no fear, that applies in the geopolitical realm. And so what's hard to accept for many people is that a lot of the so-called conservative Republicans and conservative talk radio hosts really are not taking a stand for truth. They're not taking a stand for the Constitution, and that makes them even more dangerous than the open Marxist socialist degenerates like, you know, Al Gore or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton, I think, who is going to be a worse president than even Bill was. And I'm not convinced she won't be president, because Bush has very high ratings, but so did his father, and he lost him. So it's up to whatever these globalists want. Whatever to push their agenda the furthest is what we're going to have, and people better wake up, and they better start using the Hillary test, or the scent test. If they're willing to give power to Bush, are they willing for Hillary Clinton to inherit that same power, to, you know, basically even revoke our citizenship now? If we are named by the executive branch as being in any way helpful to terrorists, and Ashcroft's testifying before a Senate Foreign Relations Committee said that those people who were complaining that the Patriot Act threatened our liberties as protected by the Bill of Rights, he said those people complaining are aiding and abetting the terrorists. And under the Patriot Act, that means that you can be rounded up.
And I think that the average American can't believe that could happen in this country. Well, believe me, it can. I did an interview this afternoon with a fellow, Major Rocky. And he, of course, looked into the dangers of depleted uranium. And one who came out publicly and said, we're killing our soldiers by the use of depleted uranium. He was ordered not to. He refused. He said, you know, I have to tell the truth. I'm a military officer. I tell the truth. Well, his house has been broken into, a bullet through his window, investigated by the IRS, constant harassment. Why? Because he's concerned that we're killing our boys. You know that over 10,000, probably closer to 20,000, of the Gulf War veterans, but the government will admit 10,000 Gulf War veterans, these young, healthy people who went off to fight for freedom during the first Gulf War, have died. And over 225,000, according to the Veterans Administration, are ill. Now, the Defense Department says it's 20,000. They're off by a figure of well over 10. In other words, it's over 225,000 Gulf War veterans are ill, and many of them because of the depleted uranium.
You know, they have a hard time hiding that, because the substantial majority of those who are ill have now filed and received disability.
But, of course, the American people don't know that. And when somebody goes on CBS and says, well, yes, the government acknowledges there are 20,000 ill, they think that if they saw it on 60 Minutes, it must be true.
That's right.
And the trouble is, if you saw it on 60 Minutes, it probably is not true, or it has been just so altered so that the American people will not understand that we're killing our own men. And
that's right.
Why would anything be that evil? And, of course, we've certainly used excessive amounts of depleted uranium in Baghdad, and a lot of those Iraqi civilians who survived the siege will die of the toxic effects of the depleted uranium, as will many of the boys who are stationed there today.
Yeah, that's the horror, that there's still this misconception that the first Gulf War, very few casualties. That's not true. There was a huge number of casualties. And there's good reason to expect that long-term we're going to see something similar. But, of course, you know, our troops are still dying, not just in Iraq by gunfire, but also in Afghanistan. And we were told, remember, if we remove the Taliban, that we're going to really throttle worldwide terrorism. Well, it's still there. You know, they have control basically in the capital, limited control. The rest of the country is under warlords who have been supplied by the United States military, and they want the same Sharia law that the Taliban imposed. So we have excuse after excuse, really, to go in there, and it's always amazing that these people like the Cheneys and the Bushes end up, their companies, getting huge contracts that, you know, finance them. We have oil companies making record profits. I don't know why the stocks aren't up in those oil companies. But you see, once again, Halliburton, different groups, no bid contracts going to these establishment people who then use those funds to work against the sovereignty of the United States.
I think it was Exxon or ExxonMobil or Texas. I forgot which one it was. They made $7 billion the first quarter of this year. Now, they got $12.5 billion in cash. This is the oil company, and we're told, oh, yeah, well, the reason the price of gasoline went up is because, you know, the shortages, you know, that were as a result of the cutback by Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein never cut back on producing oil. This is simply another example of the shams that they carry out so that the rich get richer. And, of course, the people are impoverished.
That's right. And we were paying Saddam Hussein cash, over $15 million every day, buying oil, and all he accepted was cash, right up to the beginning of the war. And, of course, we said, well, it's for humanity. Well, I mean, did the people in the street get that money? Of course not. It was going to fund this person who was created by the U.S., the U.S. government. You know what's interesting to me is that we say it's immoral for him to have these so-called weapons of mass destruction. And I think that there's a little bit of a stretch to call chemical and biological mass destruction. Nuclear, no doubt. The others are very hard to use. You have to have the perfect environment. So we made him look like this horrible enemy. Why was it moral for us to give those weapons to him to use against our enemies?
But it wasn't even our enemy. It was that brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power when we toppled the Shah of Iran.
The Shah of Iran was so pro-Western. He was even, you know, he was probably not a very good Muslim.
Anyway, you know? he was a tyrant. But remember, he was the tyrant we placed in power because we overthrew Mossadegh. In fact, it's so interesting, the man who was responsible for overthrowing Mossadegh, and this is covered in Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was a man named Schwarzkopf. Colonel Schwarzkopf, he was the father of the General Schwarzkopf. So you see how they go from generation to generation.
They really do.
And the average individual has no idea what's going on out there. But if you want to check that fact, get a copy of Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and index read for Schwarzkopf, and you'll find out that that Alan Dulles had given Colonel Schwarzkopf the money to bribe the military Mossadegh, the prime minister of duly elected prime minister of Iran, would be overthrown. So we put people in power, we take them out of power. But why, you know, I remember 1979 wondering, why would we overthrow an ally like the Shah of Iran, who had the sixth largest army and air force in the world, who certainly was pro-American? Why would we overthrow him and put Ayatollah Khomeini into power. But I was so short-sighted, I didn't understand we were creating the best enemies that money could buy, because if you go into the background of the funding of Al-Qaeda, much of it came from Saudi Arabia, and much of it came from Iran, and much of it came, of course, from the Central Intelligence Agency. And who was it who financed the Taliban? Why, the United States. That's covered in books, Dollars for Terror, and, of course, Unholy Wars by John Cooley, both books written in 1999. Now, if we finance the Taliban, and then we're suddenly saying how terrible the Taliban is, we've got to go over and overthrow them because they're so wicked and hard on women. And then, of course, we bring the Northern Alliance to power, and they are the only real power in the capital. And the Northern Alliance are communists. They've always been communists. What's wrong with this picture?
You know, and Saddam Hussein's a communist. He was not a true Muslim. In fact, the fundamentalists hated Saddam.
Now, he was a socialist, a hardline socialist.
Yeah, he's a hardline socialist. And we see this all over the world. Why do we protect Arafat? Now, Arafat's not a true Muslim. He's a Muslim in the sense that the liberation theology, communists in Central and South America are Catholic. You know, they use the cover of religion. He was a communist trained at Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow. And we have time and time protected Arafat. Now, in Israel, you cannot take him out. Our current president, in fact, I had it in the newspaper, I don't have him in front of me now, said Arafat's not a terrorist, and he told Sharon, you must leave him alone. So, obviously, there are people who want to bring about permanent war, just like out of 1984. I mean, you know, and permanent war, so we have a justification to attempt permanent peace through protecting us and taking away our liberty temporarily.
People have forgotten it was in the 1980s when the Israelis moved into Lebanon to take out the PLO, which had been harassing them and terrorizing them.
I remember that.
And, of course, Israelis were ready to just destroy the PLO once and for all. When what happened? Why, we demanded a ceasefire. We put the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Terrorist Organization, terrorists, into, our ships, and we took them to Tunisia.
U.S. ships.
What?
Those were U.S. ships.
Right, and so that they could regroup, and then they could come back to keep this whole instability going. And in other words, we create the problem, and then we always set out to solve it. It
well,
doesn't make sense
if
you look logically, but if you understand that we are creating the best enemies money can buy for ourselves and for Israel, then it all makes sense.
When you look at the greatest recipient of direct aid in Asia, it's been North Korea. Even while we refuse to build nuclear power plants here in America, U.S. tax dollars, over $4 billion, are being used to build two nuclear power plants in North Korea, even as they still hold the USS Pueblo and use it as a tourist attraction. Is there anything wrong with the picture that Bush sent representatives over to North Korea, you know, as they poured the cement to build these U.S.-paid-for nuclear power plants, even as they're talking about they're going to use them to arm missiles that can hit the United States? I mean, you know, people at some point got to say, this is not crazy. I need to recognize that there is something very unpleasant that I need to become aware of. We're building up our enemies throughout the world, and we're using the threat of those enemies to empower the United Nations as if they're going to bring security. The very United Nations who now, after putting Libya on the board that oversees human rights, now we're putting Castro up there. You know, I mean, it's time to get us out of the United Nations. Even Tom DeLay said that. We need to get back behind Ron Paul's congressional resolution, H.R., 1046, to get us out of the United Nations and get the United Nations out of the United States. We need to move in that direction.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with you at all. And talking about North Korea, you know, if you read the papers very carefully, going back a few months, you'll find out that we've been supplying massive amounts of food for North Korea. You know, of course, most of it has gone to the army, not to the people.
Right.
And then, of course, we've been supplying massive amounts of oil to the people of North Korea. And, of course, we do this. Well, supposedly then they won't build any nuclear bombs and threaten us. So if we just give them all of this, why, they'll be good people. The only trouble, they even openly admit they've been working on nuclear bombs. So why would we give food and oil and build a nuclear plant for North Korea, you know, when they are communist and when they're doing everything they can to threaten us? And the only logical explanation is we are intentionally keeping the government in power, because if they didn't have food and oil, the people would revolt, the army would revolt, and that would be the end of the current dictator.
That's right.
But of course,
and you know, that whole thing is a result of international involvement by the United Nations. And any time we have the United Nations or its affiliate organizations such as NATO or CEDAW involved, we lose. And so we've been technically at war with North Korea for well over 50 years, and it's because they need the threat of war or some sort of natural catastrophe, global warming, to terrorize people into giving up their liberties. That's the only way they could take the West, not by direct assault, until they weaken us, although I believe that we're being weakened to the point that we may actually be recipients at some time of a direct military assault, I would say most likely through Red China, or they may use their little puppet, North Korea.
Well, I think that the American people better understand that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if you listen to this program and you say this couldn't be true, well, just check out the facts we've talked about. If you want me to validate anything we've said, so this evening, we certainly have all of the documentation on that. We have helped the dictator of North Korea to stay in power. The CIA employed Saddam Hussein in the 1960s and certainly helped him during the 1980s. Of course, we brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power by overthrowing the Shah of Iran. And of course, why should we be surprised? You go back and study the regime of Adolf Hitler. We actually, our corporations and banks helped to finance Adolf Hitler before the war. In fact, after the war, we brought the head of the German Gestapo, Heinrich Mueller, to the United States. And there's a book written about him. In fact, we carry several of the books written based upon his diary and his papers. The one book comes to mind was, of course, The Gestapo Chief, The Story of Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo. The other is Mueller's diaries, both of which we carry. Now, if this is really true, why doesn't everybody know that? But should we be surprised about that when, after Khrushchev was deposed after the phony revolution in Russia, that the former head of the Soviet KGB, the former dictator of Russia, the butcher of Afghanistan, was allowed to come to the United States, would give speaking engagements, get $100,000 for every talk, and then allowed to set up his foundation and the Presidio, the military Presidio, in San Francisco. You and I could rent space there, but of course, Mikhail Gorbachev could. You know, we're just about out of time. Kevin, it's been a fascinating time. I appreciate so much your being with us. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, my parting thoughts are that for everyone who listens to Radio Liberty, you have to recognize that that we need to support financially, time, influence, and money, Radio Liberty, keep it on the air so that people have the opportunity to hear the truth. Buy the tools. Get the cassette tapes, the books. That's the ammunition in this war. Don't say you're waiting to pick up a gun. Our weapons are truth and all those things. And we need to keep you on the air and support through prayer every good organization that's standing up for God and country.
God bless you. Thank you so very much, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to have you, and I appreciate your words of encouragement.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I just want to remind you to pray for America and pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our number, 1-800-5 HIV war, because America truly is at war today. is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us Dr. Gerald Epling. We're going to be talking about memory and the mind. Dr. Epling, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dr. Stan.
Well, it's so good to have you with us. And, of course, Dr. Epling has written a book, The Future of the Mind, Your Mind and How to Use It. And, of course, this is something I thought might be interesting to our listeners because, of course, it gets into this whole concept of memory. So why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself, how you got interested in this, and what you've learned as you begin studying the mechanism of memory.
Certainly, Dr. Stan. I've always been interested in memory formation. From the earliest days, I can remember how people would see things, the same event, but have different recall of the event. I found that fascinating. From there, I went into computer science and tried to see how different systems would sense the environment and detect the environment. And then later, I came back around to the study of cognition and neuroscience, where I studied how memory is formed and what you can do to improve memory over time.
All right, fine. So, well, now, how is memory formed, and what can the average person do to improve their memory? Because, you know, some people have wonderful memories for numbers, and some people have wonderful memories for names, and some people just can't remember names or numbers. So what can the average individual do using what you've learned to improve their ability to function in society?
Well, first off, many people have trouble with names, although the recognition of faces is really quite good. I've developed a technique that draws on the research of many other people, and I call it the View-Lisa technique. And in this, I use the strength of the recognition memory for the face, and I say, view that face when you see it. Give it time for it to sink into your mind. Then listen to the person as they say their name, and find a way to work their name into the conversation. Say their name. Then associate that name with something in your mind. It can be a fanciful association, or it can be an association from the environment. I call that the View-Lisa approach.
All right, fine. Well, of course, when you're usually talking to people, isn't it a little difficult to be thinking of all of these other things about how you're going to memorize their name or remember their name, trying to rhyme their name with something or, key letters that might, of course, give you a clue. The key for recall. I mean, some people, when they're, of course, talking, have difficulty doing two or three things at one time, or they begin to sort of stammer or stutter, as I sometimes will when everything goes wrong here at the studio and I'm trying to get things organized and talk and think about what I'm going to do next all at the same time.
Yes, that can be a problem. And it's very disconcerting to look at a face long enough to form a really good impression. 3 to 5 seconds should be sufficient, but if you stand there and stare at a person for 3 to 5 seconds, they start to wonder what's up. So you have to do it with glances, just a quick glance, and try to work it in with a conversation or with what you're doing. Sometimes it won't work because you can't devote the attention to it that you need to really develop that good memory at the moment, but hopefully this will be augmented by being engaged in a conversation with the person.
All right, fine. Are there any real tricks that you can utilize that you can tell people? You know, because when you're talking to the person, if you're thinking about their name, you're not going to be able to think too well about what you're going to be talking about, or can you do that? Or is this something, a gift that certain people have and others don't?
Well, it is true. Some people are very, very endowed with a good memory, and some people don't have such a good memory. The main thing is to pay attention. Because as you pay attention, you begin to form a mental image, an item-specific bit of information on that person. And we all have this ability to do this. We all have the ability to take in detail and to know something about what we're looking at. But the ability to organize that and talk about it can be somewhat more difficult to attain. But organization is important because as we can gather this information, if we can organize it, it will stay longer. So these associations, what they're really aimed at is organizing the thought, organizing the information, and organizing that item-specific information that you gather when you look at a person.
All right. Well, of course, then, are there any other tricks that you could offer to our listeners that they might be able to begin to apply this concept?
Certainly. Everyone has an ability to remember a certain number of digits. It's no coincidence that there are 7 digits in a normal phone number. George Miller showed in 1956 that people have an ability to remember 7 plus or minus 2 numbers, so you can keep repeating it over and over to yourself while it soaks in. Being exposed to it over and over is a very good way to develop a good memory. This works with numbers, with faces. And once you get to the point that you have this basic framework, that's what you have a prepositioned asset that you can build on. You can start to add things that will enhance the memory.
All right. In practical purposes, do you actually teach memorization?
I teach memory formation, and sometimes I'll cover some tricks of memorization, use of acronyms, things like this. For example, you could look at the rainbow and you see the colors red, orange, yellow, green, and blue, but how do you remember that? You can make up a name. Roy G. Blue. And now every time that you need to recall how the colors are organized in a rainbow, you could refer to that acronym, that name.
All right. And I think this is the sort of trick that a lot of people would use. I remember that somebody once, one of these memory experts, was saying that you could remember the Great Lakes remember there are a lot of homes there. And I still remember that one. There's Huron Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior, home.
Exactly.
And of course, but then somebody has to actually figure that thing out, so that they could apply that in the course of their conversation.
Yes, and that figuring it out is the organization of the information that helps you develop a quality, long-lasting memory. It's a way to keep things on focus, keep things in your mind, and organize them for long-term storage.
And of course, you're really what you want to store it is just like a computer. Your mind really works very much like a computer, doesn't it?
It does, very much like a computer. In a computer, there are only 3 primitive processes that are used to do every computer program in the world. These processes are load, where you put something into memory, add, and then store.
All right, fine. Well, then what can we, of course, the major thing is to store and keeping that thing so that we can always pull it back, out of memory. And sometimes, but what are the tricks to get the recall of that memory? Sometimes I will be sitting and I'll try to think of a name, and I just can't think of that name. How do we facilitate being able to pull that name back into the active part of the computer?
In the same way that you work a crossword puzzle, you read some clues, you know it's out there, and gee, I'd like to know that. And then after you've focused your attention on it, perhaps you look off or move your attention slightly away from it, and then the name often comes to you.
All right. And so basically then sometimes when you keep trying to focus and trying to think too hard, you're actually not able to pull that back into focus, and you've got to go on to something else?
Yes, Dr. Stan. This is especially true if you think you know where you've seen the person, because you could be focusing on the library, by example, thinking, oh, yes, the library, right. Was it in the checkout section or down in the shelving section, administration? But you may have actually seen the person on the bus ride to school.
Okay. So then how do you recall that? Or you just you hope that it comes back into your awareness as time goes by?
You have to have a confidence that it will come back as time goes by. And this confidence, in turn, breeds success.
Well, there's some people who are really just gifted with this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful memory. They can read something, they can read very rapidly. They can retain almost everything they've read. And these people certainly have a tremendous advantage in work or in almost everything they do.
Yes, that's true, Dr. Stan. Everyone that I've encountered that has these skills, especially in reading, has had phonics training early in life. And this has helped them get these little items in their mind, and then the items being phonemes, they can string them together into words, and then they have an ability to store them better than people that have not had phonetic training.
And so really you feel that phonics is a very important part of normal development of the mind?
Oh, yes. It's a disservice not to teach children phonics when they're at the formative years, and it's tough to pick it up later, but it can be done.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've, of course, had a number of interviews with people who really claim that this has been an intentional effort, going back to the time of John Dewey, to dumb down the American children to the point where they will not, or so that they will not be able to think or think effectively. Do you think there could possibly be any truth to that concept?
I think that's absolutely true, and I think focusing on John Dewey is the exact place to put the emphasis. I totally agree with that position.
Well, now, why would anybody want to conceive of an educational program that would end up in dumbing down children rather than educating them? It's sort of like it's so difficult for people to believe that anybody would want to see large numbers of people killed for absolutely no reason or want to endanger the health of our troops. But why would anybody want to endanger the health of the minds of our children?
The only reason that I could perceive would be to control the children and to guide them into collectivist organizations.
Well, I certainly agree with that. And, of course, as we know, John Dewey was a dedicated Marxist. He was one of the signers of the original Humanist Manifesto, and he was a very evil and wicked man. Well, if you're out there across America, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. If you have any questions for Dr. Epling, who's written a fascinating book entitled The Future of the Mind, Your Mind, and How to Use It. And where do you work at the present time?
I work in Frisco, Texas.
Are you teaching there at a university or what?
Oh, I'm engaged in independent research and study of the mind. I find that I have a lot more freedom to go out and really see what's going on if I'm not affiliated with any organization.
All right, well, let's go then to Dave, who's calling from Santa Cruz with a question for you. Hi, Dave, how are you doing?
Yes, just fine. I just had a real quick one here. Question, do you have any suggestions for adults who either inadequately or never got phonics training? I'll take it on the air. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, I have some suggestions. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I would default to you, Dr. Stan. I think you have some great products available at your website.
I really think that the phonicsopoly is really an amazing thing. I have people who have been 60 years old who've told me that they bought it, they played it through, and they're playing it through again. In other words, there are 5 board games and 2 bonus games, so there's 7 games, and they've actually played all of these several times because they've learned so much from it. There's basically only 40 sounds in the English language and about 12 basic rules as to why one letter will sound one way under certain circumstances in a different way, under different circumstances. And, you can have, for instance, Matt, M-A-T, A, Matt. And then, of course, you put an E on the end and it becomes mate, A. And, of course, why does that E on the end change the sound of the A? Well, that's simply one of the basic rules. That's the sound of the silent E. But, of course, it makes the A sound like the letter should rather than the at or a sound that you get with Matt. So this is all in the phonicsopoly, and I think it's a great program. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. You can get more information or go up to our website, and we have a section on phonicsopoly. I'm not ashamed to say that I actually played the game, and I learned a great deal from playing the game. In fact, I really should play the game and spend more time at it because I realize really how beneficial it is, even for an older person, and I'm over 74 now. So I really think that you have to understand, though many of us never got this training in school, we never learned to read phonetically, and although I can read and read very rapidly, scan reading, I very often will misinterpret a word, or and I will not, for instance, because I've never trained myself to sound the words out, although I'm much, much better than I used to be. So for Dave, I think that there are programs out there. There's the phonics game. There are all sorts of phonics programs, but I don't know anything better than what we have available now, devised by Myrna Culbraith, who actually created the phonics game, and then, of course, after she sold that, why she developed a Phonixopoly. Great program, and I think the phonics game is $300-$500, something like that at the present time. Anyway, you can go up on the web, and if you were interested in Phonixopoly, why, give us a call. We'd be glad to send you some information on it. Well, basically, you have a section on the mind under stress. What are you basically covering there?
Now there I'm covering the history of research on the mind, beginning with Pavlov. Pavlov was a medical researcher in Russia, and he was trying to study the activity of the stomach. He came across a disturbing phenomenon. When the dogs would see the food, but before the food was in their mouth, they would start to salivate. And this was a disruption for Pavlov. It was not a good thing. It was a problem. He really didn't expect the dog to salivate until the food was in his mouth. So he put off studying that for some number of years, and then finally came back and studied it and found that he could condition the dog to salivate when food was put near them, or when a bell was ringing, or to a number of things.
In other words, they would associate the bell with the food coming.
Right, exactly. And he worked out the amount of time between ringing the bell and presenting the food to make the dog salivate. If it's too long, the dog doesn't make the association. But if you ring the bell and then give the food right away, there's the association. The next time you can ring the bell and wait a little longer, and eventually you can get a nice long time period between ringing the bell, presentation of the food, and still induce salivation. So that's a sort of a conditioned response.
And basically then they're finding out how to control the mind of dogs with the idea that they'll be able to control the minds of human beings as well.
Exactly. One thing that's sometimes overlooked in Pavlov's work, he found that when the cortex was removed from the dog, these associations did not form. So that suggests that the cortical structures, the outer part of the brain that we use to make our associations, is also subject to the same laws those dogs' cortexes are subject to.
Okay, fine. And so so what do you do now? You know that you can have a conditioned reflex, a salivary reflex. So then how do you apply this?
Well, one of the ways that you can apply it is to change the condition so that the dog becomes entirely frustrated and tends to become totally disoriented and unmanageable. By example, you could show the dog a circle and then give them a little bit of food, and then show the dog an ellipse, not give it any food. Obvious egg-shaped ellipse versus a nice round circle. Then you could vary the size of the ellipse until the dog can no longer perceive the difference accurately between the ellipse and the circle, and sometimes give it food, sometimes not. The dog, this becomes a random chance event, frustrates the animals, they'll start biting at their collars, they get angry, they'll start barking, they'll snap at their owners. And this sort of jerking around of the dog can go a long way to control a dog's behavior and to make him appear to be unmanageable and even to break his spirit.
Yeah. And of course, really, they've actually learned how to do this through their dog experiments. And actually, I fear that they've carried a lot of this over, through the television, through so much of what we see and hear and read into the American people today. Did you think that there is mind control and that some of these means of mass control are being used on the American people?
I do, Dr. Stan. And I have dedicated my research to showing people how to overcome this mind control, how to recognize it, and how to combat it. I put my research on the web. May I give the website?
You certainly may.
The website is www.mindjava.com.
That's mindjava.com, huh?
Yes.
All right, and so basically, what have you found that they're doing, and how can people counter this? So many people are so addicted to television today, because of course it doesn't require any thought on your own. I think radio, I love radio because people at least have to think a little bit, but when you're surrounded with sound and visual stimuli, all you do is just sit there and you become part and parcel of the program that is, you're seeing. And, of course, most people are totally unaware of the fact that many times the television is used to program ideas into our minds.
Yes. When you're staring at that TV and you've got the surround sound going, you're totally responding to the television. And a person can take and give up their control over their mind to the extent that they're like Pavlov's most complacent dogs. Pavlov found that certain dogs were more suggestible than others, and the ones that were most suggestible were the ones that would walk with their tail between their legs and were very compliant with orders, things like this. You're right, radio is wonderful. You have to use your imagination. You try to think about where the conversation is going, where it's coming from, where it will end up, how things fit together. If a person's describing something, maybe a boat on a lake, you've engaged your visual cortex, part of your brain, but you fill in the blanks. You are in control, and you make the decisions. That's a very important aspect of maintaining control of your mind.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now, could you give our listeners perhaps some examples of how this is being done today and who might indeed be doing it?
The who is a little difficult for me to really put together.
All right, well then, why don't you give some examples of what's being done and how they are being manipulated?
Certainly. Anytime you see an advertisement for a product on television, the people that put that together know that if they show a flash and a bright color, it immediately swamps your visual receptors and shuts down the majority of them and focuses your attention on the item. They know they've got about 80 milliseconds to slip in some words right then that will influence you in the long run. How many times have we seen a commercial and then gone back and watched it and then seen a new aspect of it? Or have we sat and watched a commercial and then maybe been in another room and heard it, and the words had a different sort of a sound than when we were sitting in front of it? It's this putting together of a memory for us over time that they use to control the mind.
And, you know, I think that the people have to understand the great, great, great deal of money as being put out today, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars for each one of these one-minute commercials. They know that they're going to be able to influence you through those commercials.
Exactly right.
Okay, can you speak just a little louder? We're having just a little problem here with our board getting a... could you speak a little louder?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I've just turned up the volume a little bit. How's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Now, are you on a headset?
Yes.
Okay, would you mind going to a hardline phone? Because this is one reason we're having real problems.
Okay.
Okay, fine. So you go to a hardline phone, and we'll... because when we have a... headsets, they just don't come through as well as a regular hardline phone. Are you back there?
I'm here. I'm trying to remember where I put my headset. I disconnected it and set it aside. I've now located it.
Well, fine. This is a handheld telephone?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Are we in good shape? Are you on the hardline telephone now?
Not yet.
Okay, fine. Well, we will be very, very shortly, but... this is one thing most people, of course, they work
on
their
telephone. Yeah, now I'm on the regular telephone.
Okay, fine. Well, let's see if that that does better. Okay.
Right.
Well, anyway, of course, you're talking about they would use a bright light or something very, very colorful. And then, of course, they have a certain amount of time just to get those words in, program them into your mind.
Exactly right. They have to pre-position the assets in your mind through item-specific processing. They put the imagery, which many times has meanings that are not immediately available to us, but yet somehow we recognize them as having a meaning beyond something simple. And then they have to relate these items together and then tie them to their product or to an action that they want you to perform or to become involved in. This action may be as simple as frustrating you, or it may be buy their product.
Well, one of the things that really bothers me, some of these ads, like the Gap ads, but the fast-moving, flashing lights are going from very, very quickly from one scene to another. This simply, to me, has a very irritating effect.
That's what the intention is. It's to irritate you, frustrate you, and to make you give up trying to find the organization or the pattern to what is going on in your environment. The natural environment is so beautifully organized, the way the Creator put it together. A bird flies, fish swim, the grass grows, the wind blows, you see the wheat field blowing in the wind. Everything's connected. But when you see this collage of rapidly appearing pictures, somewhere in your mind you want to organize it. You think, well, there has to be meaning to this, but there is no meaning many times. It's just put there to frustrate you.
All right, but now, how is that going to get me to actually buy the product? Because that's what it's really all about. Are they trying to get me to buy the product? I would think that putting out the amount of money that they do for production of that and then to broadcast that on television stations across America, they've got to be getting a profit, or are they simply playing games with my mind?
I think they're getting a profit. Some of it may be playing games with your mind, but they need to convince you that you need that product. If you need their chewing gum, they're going to tell you, oh, your breath will not be fresh unless you have this chewing gum or this breath spray or this breath mint. Things like this are used to try to convince people they need something when perhaps they really don't.
No, because that's the whole idea of advertising. I see all these wonderful ads for these brand new cars, and you watch those ads and think, boy, you know, I'd love to have a brand new car like that and be able to zip along the road, you know, and of course they maybe throw a little sex or something in with that. And then you suddenly see, I don't need a car. My car's fine. And yet I wonder how many people actually buy a car and put themselves in tremendous indebtedness simply because of the influence of those ads. And they must be doing fairly well because car sales are still holding up. Of course, part of that is the very, very low interest rates, and some of the companies are even saying, you know, you don't have to pay anything until the year 2004 or year 2005, and, of course, no carrying charges. It's just such a wonderful deal. But obviously, they're still doing a pretty good job with their advertisement, creating the impression in our minds that this truck is Ford Tough, or, you know, this is a Dodge Ram. And use just the way they use those words, you know, because the ram, of course, is a very forceful goat that's always, defeating the other goats. So, you know, they know how to use the terminology, and, of course, they're playing games with our minds and our reality, aren't they?
They certainly are. Many times there are conglomerates that have many products, and they know that if they can set you up in one market to want this product, you will probably move into the next market and want their other products on down the road.
All right, fine. Well, then how have they learned? There must have been some scientific studies to learn how to put together advertisements that will get the intended results.
Oh, very, very definitely. Many of the studies are out of the Gestalt school, Gestalt psychology. Gestalt psychology must be differentiated from Gestalt therapy. Gestalt therapy is heavily influenced by the socialist Gestalt psychology is more of a pure science. They study things like, if I flash this picture up for 30 milliseconds and then try to get you to recognize it 2 hours later, will you recognize it? Through these sort of studies, they can determine how long they have to put the image on the screen, what the order of putting the image is to get the maximum effect, and how to really hook you to get you interested in that. Most people are interested in, you know, fresh water, clean air, whatever, and they'll put these little hooks out there to get your interest, and if you're not interested in what they want to sell, they'll try to change the way you think to get you in a position where you will be interested in what they have. And that's how we get some of the unsavory aspects of advertising filtering into our media.
Well, what do you think about all the immorality that we see? You know, the soap operas, everybody's jumping from one bed to another. There is no sense of morality or right and wrong or concern about the traditional values of marriage or of fidelity. And, you know, and for instance, on the ER, they'll have the hero, you know, just be going from girl to girl to girl. No concern about disease, no concern about everything. Certainly, you know, in this day and age, I don't think that very many people are as promiscuous as this hero is, and yet, of course, we tend to identify with this man. Are they playing games with our minds and changing our moral outlook by what we're seeing on television?
Yes, Dr. Stan. This would be the act of desensitization. By example, the first time you see a tender bird die, it tears at your heart. You think, oh, the bird's gone. But if you see a flock of birds die, then you become a little more numb to it. Then you could go back and maybe introduce the person to individual birds dying over time, and it becomes to seem more like a normal thing, and it doesn't really affect you in the same way as before. It's the same way as killing the spirit through sexual immorality and these sort of deviant practices.
We're going to just have to take a moment here, and we're going to be back in just a moment. Well, Gerald Epling will invite your calls, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest, of course, is Gerald Epling. Dr. Epling is a psychologist, and of course, he's written a book here. And do you want to tell our listeners how they can get your book if they're interested in it?
Certainly, Dr. Stan. The book is available at the website, www.mindjava.com. And you can go there and find a way to get an electronic copy immediately, or you can order a printed copy.
All right, fine. And, of course, you have a section here on the structure of logical arguments. Now, why is that important when we're talking about memory?
That is so important because it helps us find the truth of an argument. I know that some people will try to set up a relationship. If A, then B, then C. And then they will come and substitute item Q for item B and try to get you to draw the same conclusion. And if you don't know that this is coming, or if you're not attuned to the fact that the individual items are important, you're just looking at the relational structure, you could be deceived. It also gives people a good game to play that can do nothing but help them, a good mental memory gymnastic to engage in.
All right, well, could you give us an example?
Sure. If someone were interested in going to the movies, they would say, maybe they want to set up some circumstances to go to the movies. If it's Saturday night, I'll go to the show. So that means that they're not going on Friday or Thursday. But if they really want to go to the movies, they might say, well, if it's Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or Friday or Saturday night, then I'll go to the show. The or changes everything. It makes it a tautology. It's always true. These people are always going to the movies. But if you have to make it conditional, if you put anding things together, then it may become somewhat more distinctive. If it's Saturday night and I feel good and it's a full moon, then I'll go to the movie. You really limit the number of times you'll see a movie.
All right. Is that a logical argument? Is that what you're, or are you just talking about a logical situation?
Actually, I was just trying to give an example of a logical argument.
Okay. All right. Well, then if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for the doctor, give us a call at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Now, you talk about the mind-body connection. What is that?
The third part of my three-part theory of memory formation is the actual storing of the memory over time. And that's where the body really figures in. If your body's not healthy, you're not going to be able to do the essential processing of storing the memory. Many people, as they age, experience age-associated cognitive decline. Some people contend that it's not really the age that causes the problem, it's the lack of sleep or the improper nutrition. One supplement that helps a lot of people is phosphatidylserine. Taking phosphatidylserine helps improve the integrity of the neurons in the brain and helps you actually store memories over time. So what I like to call the RISE theory, relational processing, item-specific, and essential processing, helps us focus our attention on each aspect of memory formation, and the body is engaged to a great degree in essential processing.
All right, fine. So you think then, of course, good nutrition and all the things that we talk about here as far as general health are important as far as the integrity of our mind.
Oh, yes, very much so.
All right, fine. And, of course, you talked at the beginning about the three primitive processes of memory formation. What would those be?
Well, the first process is item-specific processing. When you look at a face, you know it's a face, so you don't stop and think, wow, that eye could be on a chandelier. You know that eye goes with that face. So you have this within-item relational processing that starts. You start relating that eye to the other eye, to the nose, to the mouth, and you develop an image for the face. The face then becomes an individual item. But now you want to relate that face to an environment, such as the butcher from the supermarket. So now you've got relationships forming between items. And they're unique in that the face could actually belong to some environments, but not to other environments. So that relational processing is different from the relational processing that you do when you patch the pieces of the face together in your mind. The within-item relational processing is looking at the eyes, the nose, the mouth, and piecing that together in your mind is all-inclusive and never excludes anything.
All right. I suppose this is how a computer does that, and certainly the the identification technology that they're developing now gives you an amazing ability to identify people. They can simply see people in the crowd, run them through a computer, and that computer knows who they are. But of course, the computer can do that far better than the human being, can't they?
No, the computer is not nearly as good as a human being. Computers can fail 50% of the time. You could put a mask on or occlude one eye, change the face slightly even without a mask, and the computer would be stumble and fail. People are much better. By example, if you really want to identify a bunch of people, you could give some playing cards with faces on them to people that will be identifying these people of interest, and have them just sit and look at these faces over and over, and look for distinctive aspects of the faces, because that is how you engage item-specific processing. Looking for distinctive aspects helps you focus your attention on that one face and develop a memory for that face.
Is that why they made the playing cards up for the people they wanted to catch over there in the in Iraq?
Exactly right.
Now, is that a well-known technique? I'd never heard of anything like that before, but here they're passing out playing cards with pictures of, all the various people involved in Saddam's government. And then they use the, to identify the various people with the idea of picking them up. I don't think they've got the head people, but they certainly got a fair number of people, about a third of the people who surrounded Saddam.
Yes, it's not a well-known aspect. I did my dissertation research when just such recognition techniques. I used pictures printed on cards, and I had people study these pictures in one of two ways, and then I was able to determine through recognition testing if their memory was improving or not, or if their accuracy was improving or diminishing. And I found with item-specific processing, their accuracy was good. They were able to really identify these faces very well. With the relational processing, this would be, by example, sorting the faces into six different categories. The ability to distinguish a face from a dummy face or a lure actually diminished.
All right, fine. Now, you talk about the brain as a communications device, and of course, we use our brains as forces forming words or our mannerisms or determining our reactions. What are you specifically talking about when you talk about the brain as a communications device?
What I'm doing there is I'm trying to draw attention to the fact that no one knows where a memory is stored in the human brain or in the human mind or in the human spirit. We don't know. We can't point to a section of neurons and say, memory's there. In a computer, we can. We can point to some integrated circuits or a hard drive, and we can say, that's where the memory is, and we can be very confident that it exists just in this area. But with a human brain, there's this phenomenon where the outside of the brain becomes very active as we're forming memories. Then after the memory forms, the outside is not as active, but we can recall it with less attention, less work, less engagement of the cortical structures. So no one really knows where the memories are stored. So the best I could say with certainty is that certain parts of the brain are engaged as we form memories and as we recall them, but we don't really know where they're stored, so it has to be stored someplace, so it has to be communicated to some environment or some place. So I consider the brain as a communications device, and I draw attention to the fact that we don't know exactly how memories are stored.
Okay, well, now what's the difference between remembering and knowing?
Now, that is a good question. I'm going to go ahead and take the position of Indul Tulving, because I think that may be where you're going with this. Indul Tulving in 1985 introduced a type of memory that is knowing, such as you know your name. We have no problem with that. It's not a confusion. It's not a weaker form of memory. It could be a strong form of memory. You know your name. You're not confused. But remembering, in contrast, would include some events from the actual learning experience. So by example, you probably don't remember learning your name. You can't remember the time of day, who first told you your name, but you just know it in the same way that you know 2 + 2 = 4. But remembering does have other activity, other things, other events from the actual learning experience involved. So remembering and knowing make a very interesting contrast. Knowledge seems to be a very good thing, and it is gained through item-specific processing. If you never take these things and put them together into an organized structure in your mind, then you're very unlikely to develop knowledge or knowing things. But you may remember that you saw an item here or an item there or a picture from a collage. So remembering is more of an episodic event, and knowing is something that you carry with you.
All right, fine. We've got Dave calling back again. So, Dave, did you have another question?
Yes, I have a quick one for you, Dr. Stan, and then one for Dr. Epping. Dr. Stan, you know, in the last hour, you had Kevin...
Kevin Shannon, right.
What was his name again?
Kevin Shannon.
Shannon.
Right.
You know that you had a dropout there early on in the program,
yes,
and it happens that it dropped out right when he was going to give his website address, and I don't know whether you know it or not. Maybe you can give it now, or you can remember and find out and give it to us later.
Well, I think it's called welchfoundation.com, welchfoundation.org.
Welch?
Welch, W-E-L-C-H, foundation.org.
Foundation.
Dot org or com. I'm not sure which one it is.
All right.
But we did have a little a technical problem. In fact, our first program was a disaster. We couldn't connect up with our station up there in Washington, the state of Washington. And, of course, we were going to them over telephone. And then we couldn't, at least we were able to keep the program going, although I was in under the table at times connecting wires or regular engineers at a Bible study tonight. So we just had to do a little work on our own here. But
we do understand, and we appreciate that you go through all of these problems and get us some of the best information available on the media.
Well, thank you so much.
For Dr. Epping, there's a subject that I've been very interested in, and here you've got a specialist on this, and it has to do with brain control and stuff, and relating to the things that have been going on in our schools, like Columbine, and we've had something like, coming up on 10 different conditions where we had kids coming to school with weapons, shooting other students and shooting teachers and principals, and then killing themselves. And to me, this sounds very, very much like a Manchurian candidate thing, and I was wondering if he had any insight into that and was making observations on that subject.
All right. Did you get the question, Dr.
I got the question. Yes, Dave. Thank you for asking. There is a part of the brain that deals with memory formation, the deep brain that is subject to serotonin manipulation. In each of these conditions, I have no direct knowledge, but I do question whether there were some interruption of these serotonin pathways through manipulation with certain drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors in particularly. Many times these drugs should be used just for a short time under the care of a psychiatrist that's dealing with a specific issue. I don't know that that's always the case. I do worry about that.
Are you
that.
Thinking our students are getting these kind of drugs?
I'm suspicious that they may be.
Oh, certainly in Columbine, one of the boys was on Luvox, which is a skiffing cousin of Prozac. And actually, we did an interview with a fellow who analyzed all of them. At least a third and probably closer to a half of all the school shootings, these children were on one or another psychotropic drugs. But this was never brought out by the controlled media.
Is there implications that someone is going in on top of these drugs and using them as a gateway to control the minds of the children?
Well, do you want to comment
just
on that?
Just the drug by itself.
Well, first of all, I would. Why don't you comment on that, Gerald, and then I'll give my thoughts.
As I understand it, these drugs are used to change an individual's perspective and to open them up to new possibilities and help to redirect their life onto another path. Therefore, they would be very susceptible, and they might not even be listening to their own conscience like they would if they were not taking the drugs. So I would think that they would be susceptible to some real bad influences at that time.
Like killing themselves after pulling off a shooting.
Well, the thing is, first of all, you have to understand that sometimes forgotten whether it's 4 or 5% of Ritalin, they will get a psychotic reaction to it. Well, I think you have to understand that, Dave, there are many factors, other play here in our country. One of them, of course, is the use of aspartame, which has a specific toxic effect on the brain. It leads, of course, to epileptic seizures, and I'm sure it has a profound impact on this normal serotonin pathways. We know that fluoride has a profound impact on the brain. In fact, the main ingredient in Prozac and many of these drugs is a fluoride compound. So we're playing games with our young people by, of course, encouraging them to use things with aspartame, that's NutraSweet in it, the Diet Coke, Diet Pep, knowing full well the damage it can do to the brain as well as
this
the fluoride.
Is this just a side effect, or have they got some agenda in their minds when they're pulling this off?
Well, of course, my personal view is that we're dealing with some very evil and wicked people. But not only that, but of course, we're taking any relationship to God out of our educational program. We're teaching children something called values clarification. You know, if you're in a rowboat and there's only room for four people and there are six people there, who are you going to throw overboard? What, you know, a 10 or 12 or 14-year-old child wants to think that they're going to throw certain people overboard and make those decisions of the DARE program, which, of course, is being used in our schools all across the country, is aimed at teaching children to make their own decisions as to what's right and wrong. Well, if you don't have a relationship to God, if you don't know there is a right and there is a wrong, if you don't know there are any absolutes, how are you ever going to make a decision? You'd never have to train a child to be bad. They do that automatically. It's a matter of training them to be good. And that's, of course, why we are told to bring up our children in the way of the Lord. So we got a real problem with what's happening in our schools today. And if you're a parent and you try to discipline your child at home, why, you can get into all sorts of problems. In fact, many parents are so intimidated by the system that threatens to take their children away if they discipline them, that, of course, they don't discipline them at all, and then we get into real problems. And I think that, of course, we have changed the attitude of many of the parents towards their families, and the children are there, but they're not close to them. We've destroyed the closeness of the family, and, of course, our society is creating all sorts of problems. I believe we are seeing a nation in decline, and, of course, if you lose a generation of children, you lose the nation. And there are people who would destroy our nation by destroying the relationship of our children with God. They've done a great job. Anything else? What are your thoughts?
Thank you, Doc. If you saw me, you see my head shaking up and down. I totally agree with this, and I'll take any more on the air. Thank you again.
Thank you for calling, Dave. And what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Epley?
Oh, the problems out there are defined, sometimes better defined in certain circumstances than others. But I think the good news is we do have hope for the future. The Christian faith gives us that hope, and we can apply our mind to things that we would like to build that are good. We can read Proverbs, and in that way help develop a good mind. We can read the Psalms. We can apply these principles to our lives. I actually have developed an acronym for my three-part memory formation theory, the processes involved, that I call RISE, R-I-S-E. Relational processing, item-specific processing, and essential processing. Now, I've drawn heavily on the research of many people. I did not invent item-specific processing. I did not invent relational processing. I threw essential processing in there because I think it's important to really look at how the memory gets stored. But if we can just remember RISE, relational processing, item-specific, and essential, then any situation we walk into, we can consider, gee, what's going on here? Are people trying to develop some relationships in my mind to some items, or are they just trying to scramble my mind? Because if you can scramble the mind, that's often a prelude to offering a solution that maybe you wouldn't normally accept. But as long as you're focused on forming your own memories, making up your own mind, and making your own opinions, you can triumph over these problems. Somebody's going to try to control your mind. You may as well do it yourself.
I agree with that totally, and I think that unless they understand that there is an organized, orchestrated effort at mind control in our society today, using television, using radio, many of our talk show hosts pretend to be conservative, but of course they are really the best conservatives that money can buy. And when any mention is made of conspiracies, if many mention is made of this really satanic conspiracy we talk about, and certainly the move towards the New World Order, the One World Government, the person will immediately be attacked and vilified, and they'll be sorry they ever called the program. And then, of course, everybody else out there, because they identify with the intelligent talk show host who speaks so eloquently, why, of course, then they tend to agree that anybody believes that there's a move towards a world government must be some sort of a kook, as it were. So, you know, they know exactly how to manipulate the people. And one of the biggest problems that I have, people call me a dozen times a week and say, you know, I keep trying to tell others about what's going on, but they don't want to listen. And even the people in my church, they don't want to listen. They say, I don't have any faith in God because I'm concerned about what's going on. Or, you know, or we don't understand what's taking place. And they don't want to hear about it. And of course, this is the real problem. And I believe there's a spiritual blindness that, of course, really consumes so many of our people today who are incapable of looking at what's going on and saying, hey, there's a real problem here. And this is the difficulty we face. If people don't understand there's a problem, they're not going to be looking for a solution. They're not going to be looking for answers. Our job is to try to make people think. How can I be more effective, do you think, Dr. Epling, in getting people to know there's a problem and to begin to utilize this God-given intelligence that we have? How are we going to break this mind control that really consumes so many of our fellow citizens today?
I would just like to first say that you're very effective. I'm honored that you would ask my opinion on this, because I consider you one of the most effective people in this way that I know of. You have said in the past you ask people questions and try to get them to think. Very, very important aspect. It's also important to give people a framework. The framework can be knowledge in itself. The ability to look at something, organize it in the mind, and clarify it is very important. If a person is going to just look at a few things and say it's wrong, that's good. But if it makes them uneasy and uneasy with their own mind and their own memories, they'll never come back to it, or at least not for a long time. And I am surprised at the number of people that when they actually see these things, they actually touch it, they recoil. They don't want it in their mind. They don't want to know that something's wrong. And interestingly enough, the problems that they're recoiling from are oftentimes embedded in their mind, these images, these things that are not really good for them or good for society or good for people. They don't want to think about that as being not good. They just want to go on enjoying life, being happy, carpe diem, this sort of thing, enjoying the day. One of the hardest things I've found is to convince people that they can organize something in their mind. I was talking to a person about just imagine a really large bolt and a nut, and imagine screwing the nut on, and think about whether that would turn to the right or to the left. And the person became very upset because they thought I was doing mind manipulation, because I wanted them to imagine something that they saw or that they could see in the environment. I think that's the hardest thing that I have found, is to get people to look, see, and then actually try to organize it in their own mind. It's like they've lost control over their minds to the extent that it's scary when they actually reach out and take control. Do you see any of that, Dr. Stan?
Oh, you know, I'll never forget when I first got started, because I was about 33 years old, as I remember, was 1962. And when somebody challenged, you know, everything I believed, you know, I just could not accept any of this as being true. But at least I was willing to begin to read and study to find out if it was true. And, you know, I had, of course, gone to my medical school and my college and, you know, and my orthopedic training. I spent 4 years in residency after a couple of years in the military. And then, of course, you know, I've got to, but I hadn't read a magazine or a book or anything but applying myself in medicine for so many years. And then when somebody made some suggestions that we were really a republic and not a democracy, that our government had actually brought Fidel Castro to power in Cuba, knowing he was a communist, and of course they're talking about Operation Keel Hall and some of the things that happened during the Second World War, and I set out to determine whether they were true or not. And when I suddenly realized they were true, when I suddenly broke that control that existed over my mind. It was the most exhilarating experience, suddenly to be able to pick up a newspaper and not read it for what it said, but to be able to say, what are they telling me that isn't true? What are they trying to make me believe? And at that point, suddenly, no matter what happened, I was free of their control over my mind. The tragedy is we've got several hundred million Americans who are not free, who are not thinking, who are simply accepting everything they hear, see, or read as truth without the realization that somebody is out there playing games with their minds.
That switch that threw in your mind when you realized you were free and you could think, and you could put things together on your own, that is a source of fear to those that would control society. That's a good thing.
Well, that's why I do what I do 5 hours a day, you know, and then on the weekend programs, because, you know, I'm just hoping that somebody is going to be surfing the dial, is going to hear what we say, and suddenly they're going to say, hey, that's true. That's exactly what's going on today. So that is our goal. That's our objective. And hopefully we will reach some people out there. And I don't know how many people we will reach, but every person we reach can begin to reach their friends, their family, the people in their church. And hopefully we're going to build up at least a good base of people. It doesn't take a majority to redirect the direction we're going. It only takes a small, dedicated minority. They're only a small minority who understood what was going on at the time of the American Revolution. Now, we don't need a revolution, a military revolution. We need a revolution in thought and a revolution in determining what's really important. And, of course, begin to relearn the long-forgotten story of our heritage of freedom here in America, which is why we do what we do and encourage people to form their institutes on the Constitution in their local community so that they can begin to project that knowledge to others. Well, we're just about out of time. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes more. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners today?
Read Proverbs. You can't go wrong with that. If you're interested in scientific evidence that shows people grow new brain cells in the hippocampal formation into their 60s, go out to the website, mindjava.com. I've got a citation out there. And there are a lot of things you can do with your mind. The mind, the brain is very plastic. You can learn things rapidly. You see a visual image, 2 minutes later, it's going to be in memory. There are things you can do, and there are things you can do rapidly to overcome any obstacle. And I would encourage you to do that. And go to mindjava.com and take a look.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you so very much. Our guest has been Dr. Gerald Epling. We've been talking about his book on mind and the use of the mind. Remember his website, mindjava.com, isn't it?
That's right, Dr. Stan.
All right, God bless you, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr.
Bye-bye.
Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. And this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. And, Chris, this is the time I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, reaching out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you'd like to learn more about our organization, give us a call. First of all, if you'd like a free copy of my March newsletter, which will tell you the truth about the Iraqi war, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers. We ask you to pray for our boys overseas there in Iraq, many of whom are being poisoned by the depleted uranium that is just scattered all throughout that tragic country. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, when we hope things run much more smoothly, this is Dr. Stan. Good night, and may the Lord be with you.
I wonder my hair is going gray.